This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
1988 was an interesting year. A presidential election was underway. The Mets were in first place. And a public radio station in Albany, New York, decided to begin producing a weekly radio program on health issues hosted by Dr. David Carpenter. It was called The Health Show.
25 years, several hosts and producers, and 1,317 episodes later, we come to the final installment of that show. On today's Health Show, we'll look back at some of the segments of the show that we are most proud of.
We'll hear some of the conversation with Nina and a colleague about their experiences as breast cancer patients.
Listen to some of Bob's interview with a man who helped eradicate smallpox from the world.
And hear our award-winning conversation with people living with terminal cancer. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sass.
And this is The Health Show.
In October of 2008, we ran a long segment with me and Dr. Janet Gargiulo about what was new in the field of breast cancer. Ironically, a year later, both Janet and I were battling breast cancer. It was my second go-around with the disease and her first. Once our health had stabilized, Bob got us back together and we talked about the experience. I discovered my cancer during a breast self-examination, and Bob asked Dr. Gargiulo if that was unusual in this age of mammograms and MRIs.
I don't think it's unusual. I think a lot of women find their own cancers. You know, I mean, they do have their mammograms and their digital mammograms, but sometimes something can develop in between studies. And fortunately, women do still do breast exam and do discover these cancers.
And how did you find out you had a problem?
I had an abnormal mammogram.
Where do you go when something like that, you see an abnormal mammogram? Is this a thing where you get called at home or at the office and say, we saw something, what comes next?
Well, actually, in my case, I have my mammogram next door to where I work. Where I have a good relationship with the staff. So they contacted me right away that day and said they wanted me to have more views. And my own take on it was that they were overreading because I was a physician. But I did do as they asked. Mm-hmm. And I went back for the extra views and an ultrasound. And the radiologist went over it with me right then and there. And still was convinced that it was something that needed further looking. But I was still sort of in denial. And he asked me, did I want an MRI or a biopsy? And I figured I'd go for the less painful option. So I opted for the MRI, which was very abnormal.
Did you see yourself reacting as you've seen some of your patients react to this very situation?
Probably.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Could you see the look on your doctor's face going, come on.
Well, I mean, I didn't argue with him. When he said, you do this, I said, okay, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't argue. But in my head, my dialogue was, you know, he's overreacting.
Yeah, I didn't realize how powerful denial is. Because even in my case, I'm feeling something. I'm going, oh, no, it's scar tissue from my radiation, from, you know, I had myself talked out of it just the same way Janet did. And it wasn't the case, but it's a powerful denial, so powerful. So I'm going to remember that when I speak to my own patients and kind of manage their care. I'm going to keep that in mind.
You found something with your own self-exam. Where did you go after that?
I'm lucky. I called my friend, the radiologist, and I was in having an MRI, an ultrasound, and a biopsy on the same day. Now, that's not going to happen for most people, but there I was, and there was the diagnosis right there.
So the relationship that you have with your doctors then, does that, do you think it makes it easier for them to deal with it? Or do you think they're kind of like walking on nails or walking on glass? Or are they just kind of giving you the facts? Here it is, boom, boom, boom. You understand, let's do it.
Well, actually, I don't know how it was with Nina, but with my doctor, he wanted to, you know, go over everything and give me hand. Well, actually, it was more for my friend who would go to the appointments with me. And you know, I said, listen, because I'm a breast cancer specialist, do I need to listen to all this information about the side effects of chemo and, you know, what kind of surgery I need, et cetera, et cetera? So we compromised and he gave her a book.
I love it.
And it was fine. I mean, she was fine with that. I was fine with that. But if I have questions, I ask them. But I think that the reason that we had a good relationship and still do is because I trust him. I mean, I think that a person needs to choose a doctor that they trust and they're comfortable with, because you can't be second guessing the person. I just don't feel that that's helpful in your treatment plan, or running to the internet, or in my case, running to journals to see, is he doing the right thing.
When choosing a treatment, the first time you went through this, I'm assuming things were, you tried to do the least invasive treatment you possibly could. And this time, was it, you know, different? Was it okay? Throw everything at it this time?
Well, no, it's not exactly like that. I was diagnosed in 1996, and I had what is now termed triple negative breast cancer. And at that time, the treatment was very, very aggressive. Okay. And involved high-dose chemotherapy. And actually, at that time, they were doing stem cell transplants, kind of like a bone marrow transplant. So my treatment was very aggressive at that point. This time around, I had a more, what we might call a more conventional estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, which was treated more with surgery and also chemotherapy, but not quite to the same level as last time.
So these were two different separate cases? It wasn't
That's
a reoccurrence
correct.
Of the
no,
first?
No, two separate breast cancers, two different breast cancers.
Well, I'm going to go to the breast cancer expert in the room and say, how unusual is that for someone to hit the lottery like that twice?
It is unusual. I mean, it does happen. It happens to 5 to 10% of women that they develop a second breast cancer. But 14 years later is a little, you know, unusual. Usually you expect it to happen a little sooner rather than that late.
Would you have been more surprised to see a reoccurrence of the first kind after 14 years?
Yes, yeah. Okay. Definitely. I think she's cured of that first cancer.
Thank God.
Yeah. Gratefully.
Dr. Jana Gargiulo is a retired medical oncologist from New York Oncology Hematology in Latham, New York.
And Dr. Nina Sachs, thankfully, is still here, alive and kicking.
There are people who do great things, and there are people who ask them questions about those great things. I fall into the latter category. Dr. D.A. Henderson is in the former. In 1967, he was enlisted by the World Health Organization to rid the world of smallpox. A little more than a decade later, smallpox was history. In 2009, I spoke to Dr. Henderson and asked what it was about smallpox that made that the target for eradication.
Well, smallpox has been, throughout history, the worst pestilential disease people can experience. And even in this country, as late as 1972, we were still vaccinating. All children had to be vaccinated before they went to school. We hadn't had a case in 23 years in the United States when we finally stopped in 72. And around the world, this has been a disease which has killed hundreds of millions of people. It's been the most feared disease of all time.
Let's go back for a minute and just talk about smallpox. As a disease, what does that do to a person?
Well, it's caused by a virus, and the individual will inhale it, if you will, from a patient, droplets. He'll feel perfectly well for 10 or 12 days, and he'll develop a terribly high fever, absolutely miserable, aching all over, go to bed. And then a little rash begins to appear. It's on the face and then the arms and the rest of the body. And these are little like pustules and little boils, little tiny boils. And they begin to expand. And a boil is very painful as it gets bigger. And these are just all over the body. They're in the mouth. They're over the tongue. So the individual had trouble eating, he had trouble drinking, and it would go on for a good 10, 12 days before the scabs would form and they'd fall off. But 3 out of 10 people died. There was no treatment for it at all. And a number of them were left blind as a result of this.
Hmm. How contagious was it?
Yeah, it was moderately contagious. If you got a case in a household, that most of the other people in the household would be, come down with the disease. But the thing of it was that the individual didn't spread the disease until after he got this high fever and began to feel miserable. And so most of the people just went to bed. They felt so terrible. So they weren't out wandering around to spread it. And that made a big difference.
Well, by the time you came along with your eradication program, the vaccine had already been developed for some time. When was that vaccine developed?
The vaccine is our first vaccine. It was developed back in 1796. You can believe it. It was an English physician, a country physician by the name of Edward Jenner. And the lore at the time said that dairymaids got an infection called cowpox from cows, and they were protected from the smallpox, and indeed they were. So he took a little material from one of the pustule on the dairymaid's hand and then inoculated a little boy and later showed that he was protected against smallpox. So it was our world's first vaccine.
Well, you had a vaccine. You lived in a country where there hadn't been a case in a while. You were given this task. How did you begin?
Well, we had $2.4 million altogether for that was to cover the world. And we couldn't even buy the vaccine we needed at that point. So we had to really start from scratch. But most of the countries were actually very fearful of smallpox. And if we could get vaccine for them, then they would join in. And if we get a little money to buy a few vehicles, they would be able to do a lot more. And so little by little, we built a program. And fortunately, this was an interesting time because we got a lot of help from the Russians, who provided 25 million doses of vaccine every year. And the Americans also gave vaccine and provided help. So it was during the worst days of the Cold War, I had the support of both the Soviet Union and the United States.
If anything showed how much this disease was feared, that did.
Indeed, it did. Travelers all over the world, to go from one country to another, your country, had to have a little booklet. And in that was a marked when you had to be vaccinated within the previous 3 years, even to get admitted to the country. It was true in the United States. It was true in other countries. We were so afraid of somebody bringing the disease in. And this is the only disease for which everyone had to carry this little yellow card. The first year we began, we were able to estimate that we had about 10 million cases and about 2 million deaths that year. So that it was a bad, bad problem.
Well, mass vaccinations, of course, was one of the things you had to organize. But you said surveillance was at least equally as important. Tell us what you meant by that.
Well, up until 1967, when the program began, people, when they felt they had a lot of cases of smallpox, they'd go out and governments would do a big program and vaccinate a lot of people, and they'd report how successful they'd been as they'd vaccinated so many people. But the idea of keeping track of where the cases were and when they occurred and what you did about it, that was just a new idea. So what we did was to try to get every health center and every hospital in each of the countries to report every week if they had cases of smallpox. And then when they reported them, we had the countries set up a team which would go out. And the team would go out where the case was, see if there were other cases, and then they'd vaccinate all around the cases, like a circle, if you will. So we said go and visit to the village and vaccinate 30 houses around where the cases are. Well, what this did was then provide the people who got vaccinated would be protected, and the individual had the smallpox couldn't spread to anybody. And this had a tremendous effect when we found we were able to stop the smallpox altogether in large areas, even though we'd only had maybe 50%, 60% of the people vaccinated. And this made things go very much faster, and it was surprising how rapidly we could set up these reporting systems, which they were just not used to reporting anything from health centers. And to get a report every week, it was a sort of the foundation for much larger programs of reporting, which so many of the countries began after the smallpox program.
Dr. D.A. Henderson wrote a book about the campaign to eradicate smallpox called Smallpox, the Death of a Disease. In 2002, he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President George W. Bush for a lifetime of work in the service of his country and humanity.
Still to come, a look back at some people who shared their experiences with terminal cancer. That's next on The Health Show.
You will still be able to find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. That's healthshow.org.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1317.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
In 2006, I sat down with three people who were in various stages of fighting cancer. Maureen Kearns was a retired elementary school teacher. Mark Burke was an electrician and musician. And George Lewis was a dairy farmer and manager of a roofing business. They were all candid about their disease and what life still held in store for them.
In the beginning with my disease, I used to say that I played peekaboo with it. You know, I would look at it for a few minutes and what it meant. Then I would, since it wasn't impacting my life at the moment, I would go back to doing the things that I normally would do. And so I looked at it a little bit at a time, and I was only after I had been in treatment for a while that I began to really think about what the meaning was going to be for me.
My wife actually asked me, now that you have this terminal disease, I don't know how to treat you. I don't know what you want. I don't know what you want to do. You know, I'm a stubborn and irrational fella, and basically what I wanted was just to keep on doing the things I was doing, leading the life I enjoy. Even though we're confronting this disease, I really didn't want my life to change. Maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm just lying to myself, but basically my life was where I liked it to be at the time I was diagnosed, and I didn't want anything to change.
My disease influences what I can do and what I can't do, but there are spaces and pieces of time when I can do what I would normally do when I'm feeling well. And I've found many ways to bring things into my life that give me joy.
To do anything that makes you feel good and happy will help your disease. I finally realized that I've been told this, but I am a workaholic. And being able to be productive as possible, has been very important.
I was retired about 10 months before I was diagnosed. So I walked into retirement thinking that I was a healthy person, which I had been all my life long. I think I came to a realization of what my life would be like a little bit at a time. It wasn't until I started to look and decide where I was going to be treated that I realized that my opinion was going to come into play. The only early decision that I made around my disease was that I wanted to live peacefully. That was kind of like a seed that grew, and with the help from a lot of people, I was able, along the way, as I gained more experience, to decide what peaceful meant to me and what opportunities were there.
It's not something that you can dwell on. You can't think about this every minute of your awake life. Otherwise, you know, you might as well just crawl in the box right off. Ignoring terminal illness is a big part of living with it.
I think growing up on a dairy farm, you learn Mother Nature, the power to be, or whatever controls our destiny, becomes reality on a farm very, very quick. You see a new calf being born and it's as healthy as can be, and you come back in 6 hours and it's gone. My grandfather explained to me, probably when I was 2 or 3 years old, that was God's way of, there was something wrong with that calf. So I think that probably helped me as much as anything, is having that basis of life and death. Also, that we don't control much. People that I've seen with cancer that have a hard time dealing with it are people that have really felt they have controlled every step of their life. A farmer realizes he controls very, very little.
What I told my doctor, and I've learned to talk to my doctor, in the beginning I was into pleasing him and not saying too much, and probably about a year ago I warned him that I had developed an opinion. So he better beware, because I was going to tell him what I wanted. Once I said I liked when I heard him whistling, and the next time I went in for treatment, the poor man whistled himself to death, you know, and that meant a lot to me.
When I was diagnosed, I went out and bought a medical dictionary so I could understand the big words, and it would help me with my questions when I went back. What I found was I got to be friends with patients that were there that would call me and say, well, I just came back from the doctor and he said this, and I wonder why he said this and that. Did you ask him? Well, no, I didn't, because he seemed to be busy or she seemed to be busy. And I think a lot of people were embarrassed to ask questions that maybe they didn't understand. You know, a doctor can't call an elbow, it's another name.
You can't live your life saying, I'm never going to die. You know, people don't think about death. We've been sort of forced to, but we only have to think about it a little more than everybody else. It's only a little more imminent. That's how I look at it.
When I was handed the book that said, with your kidney cancer and with your type and level of lymphoma, 85% of the people will die within 3 to 4 years. I mean, I had to decide that day, I was probably one of the 15% that wouldn't.
Life still has all the positives it ever had. The only thing is, we're guaranteed that at some point they're going to cease. Well, everybody's got that same guarantee. We're winning the race on this. We're going to beat the rest of you.
What I've appreciated myself is just somebody who can take this journey with me. I don't expect anybody to fix it, but the people that have been able to be with me, irregardless of where I am at that day, I might be happy, I might be sad, I might be, you know, whatever. But the people that can just be there with me are really valuable people to me.
I think when you start out as a doctor, you want to help everybody and do it. I would imagine that once you have lost your first 4 or 5 or 6 patients, and you have worked very, very hard to give them everything you could do to make them live, that there's a point you have to harden yourself and say, I can't emotionally get involved with a patient. And I think that's the turning point for a new doctor.
And yet at the same time, we're asking them to still be emotionally available on some level in order to treat us correctly. And, you know, we ask a lot of our doctors as it is, I think, I don't want to say I'm on the doctor's side, you know, that I don't know if I could get a ride home if I did that. But as individual as patients and doctors are, every patient wants the best care that they can get. I think most doctors want to give the best care they can give.
The complexity of that job is just amazing to me. And then a little voice in my head says, you need to have a heart. You need to follow your heart too, to do your best work. And I can't imagine being that person or trying to be that person, but I'm glad that there are people that can.
Maureen Kearns, Mark Burke, and George Lewis have all since passed away. This segment won the 2007 Communicators Award for Editing in News. And that's all the time we have for The Health Show. If you'd like to listen to any of our programs from the past several years, they'll remain online at healthshow.org. We hope we've been able to inform, to entertain, maybe provoke a little thought about your own health and the state of healthcare in general. I know the last 9.5 years producing and hosting this show has made me a smarter person, as has working alongside one of the smartest and bravest women I've ever met.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you so much. It's been my honor and a pleasure, and I've learned a great deal as well.
Nothing more to say. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy, and thanks again from all of us here at The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.